Hello and welcome to Culture Terror. I am DK.
All post 2000 policemen do is pull over driver, give white driver ticket, and lie. I'm Lewis.
No lies detected. This is going to be, I think, something of an experimental episode. It's an important cultural phenomenon. My reservation comes from, we wanted to talk about prestige. You had this idea about talking about prestige and occupational prestige in particular, and I guess occupational prestige in the context of America, even more specifically. I mean, this, it's such an enormous anthropological topic that, it's one of those things that, like, and I also don't necessarily trust research that has been done, just because anthropology
it's very much based on, like, the vibe, like, how prestigious is, how do you measure prestige, right? It's just a vibe.
Yeah. Very much so. Yeah. But, and it's also one of those things where I don't even know, like, a social history of prestige would be a history of society. You know, when you talk about it just being a vibe, it's kind of communal vibe that would define a society as such in the first place. So where do you, this is like origins other than, yeah, I mean, whatever kind of origin story you want to tell about.
I think the best way to do this is to start at, because you can't start in Rome, right? It's like, well, the military in Rome was prestigious, right? I think to get baseline America, you start at like 1900, right? That's the baseline of America, right? And then you compare that to like present day and like chart how things shifted. I think that's probably the best way to do it. It's like to look, so you don't really go all the way back. It's probably the cleanest way to do it, if that makes sense.
Sure. Sure.
Do you have a place you want to start? Because I have a couple jobs.
No, this was your idea, and I'm down for the ride. So yeah.
So the biggest jobs that I want to get into that has had probably the most prestige movement is the police, is being a policeman. Policeman, what was basically in 1900, like, you are just like the mayor's thugs or the sheriff's thugs, only in urban areas. There weren't many policemen, period. There were undermanned, understaffed notoriously. It was equivalent to a garbage collector. In fact, very similar, like pushing bums out of areas they shouldn't be, occasional, like, stopping riots with gunfire, like, things that are
okay. So here's my first question. Maybe you don't know the answer, but or maybe you have a better sense than I do. I don't know, but because I think you're right. I mean, from what I understand, and having talked with people who do, who have, you know, like scholars, I guess, of this kind of material, the depiction in, for example, Gangs of New York, which is, I guess, a little later, it's like the 20s or something, right? But it's I think. Sorry,
that's post Civil War.
Very much.
That's before
Right, but that's also very much part of that vibe of, because I've never seen the movie. Okay. Well, maybe that's a. But anyway, people. Someone was telling me that, as I understand it, that's a good depiction of, yeah, as you say, the kind of police as thugs, and that's, I think, certainly just the government's thugs, right? And that tracks for sure. And I think there's never a point at which that wasn't going to be part of the dynamic, in terms of, like, you're always going to have some kind of domestic security service, whether that's local police or some kind of, you know, for relevant cases, federal police or whatever, you know, the King's Guards or something, the Praetorian Guard in the Roman Empire, you know, we talk about the Romans,
it's actually true, because, like, at the same time period, some of the Gendarme military policemen were well regarded. Like, Gendarmes have always been around. Like, in France, they're still the police, or most police. Yes. They're metro police. Yeah. But, like, America doesn't have a history of Gendarmes, really. We have military police, but it's like a very niche thing. And they've always been because they have like a higher association with the military and prestige and the king, whereas generally the police work for like the mayor. Even sheriffs not even having a staff is relatively new. Like, they would.
The sheriff of Nottingham, right? I mean, this is like you know, I think that people talking about, like, people understand this kind of traditional disdain for local law enforcement going back centuries. I guess my social historical question is that, you know, the extent to which these things have diverged, or maybe that's the answer to the question then, is the kind of policing function as exercised by a relevant military versus or which is to say the state as such, versus like whatever kind of local delegate of state authority is gonna come get your taxes.
Yeah. And well, the other thing is that this change, obviously, like somewhat during after World War One, but massively after World War Two, and in the 1980s, like traditionally, if you wanted a crime solved, you had to pay a Sherlock Holmes type, a inspector. There were, the state would have a few like very high end, like actual crime solving guys, but generally, like, you could not go to a police, like the expectation somewhat now, but not really anymore. But like in, like, we'll call, like, this shifted into like the golden age of professionalization post World War II, which happened because of like television and prohibition and like the police becoming, like, the idea that police as a counterweight to organized crime is even somewhat new. Like, organized crime existed and the police existed in New York City in 1900, but like they didn't, the idea of them as like oppositional in a good guys, bad guys way, as opposed to just like, once again, rival thugs, would have been interesting. And, you know, media and like the idea of taking on organized crime made police kind of like the white hat good guys. And then during World War II, which is when I think when police really get shiny and professionalized and people begin to respect them, and like the idea you can go to a policeman to solve a problem comes around, is because of both TV and the great migration of American blacks to the rest of the country. And they, you know, these non-segregated northern cities needed a faction of people to enforce segregation that didn't exist, but obviously did. And the job of policemen in America post-World War II was to just keep black people out of white neighborhoods. And that being an important function in the society, raised their prestige, like, massively. And also television at the same point, them having all this good guy cachet from organized crime issues in the 30s, you got like very positive portrayals of Mayberry and cops that you could go to with problems and they would fix, and in many ways they would. And populations increasing also meant like what used to be just a simple sheriffs in the suburbs would raise a posse for an incident now had to have like permanent staff. So you saw massive expansions of police sizes and budgets and money. And the idea that police were supposed to like stop crime in very meaningful ways. You know, obviously you call the cops when it's murdered, but like the idea that, you know, that would actually like, the idea that the police solving murders leads to them like slowly like stopping crime and reducing crime rates and even tying crime rates to things like the police performance is all a product of this kind of time period of, you know, massive growth in everything in America in terms of money and prestige and competence and professionalism and education. And this is where police get their reputation that they've basically been pissing away since the year 2000. Because I think you're seeing them come back down. Like, the police have had the most movement on this front because they've had such a brutal decline from it, you know?
Yeah, well, there's a lot going on there. I was, as you were talking about solving murders, I like the image was, okay, well, I'm going back through, okay, all I have access to is media and I'm not a historian or anything, but okay, thinking through media depictions, which I'm going to assume are broadly reflective
of attitudes
of reality. Probably, yeah, yeah, and also to some extent of reality, or at least insofar as it tracks with like other stuff I am more familiar with. But like, so you have detectives in the 1930s, obviously, right? I mean, this is like a whole genre unto itself. both police detectives and a lot of private eye types.
That's the funny thing, right? Like the better one. Yeah. It's in like in terms of a competence thing, you want the private guy.
Yes.
The guy who works for the
city. But they would work. I mean, and that goes also back to Sherlock Holmes, which is, you know, pre World War I, of course. So the point being that this is not a kind of, maybe it's to some extent post-industrialization, but it's definitely not, you know, like the post 20th century cataclysm. You know, Sherlock Holmes, the whole part of the whole vibe there was like the police, like what's the inspector or the whatever, I forget, you know, the police inspector that he's always with Scotland Yard, that who's, you know, he's not incompetent. He's not, you know, completely terrible at his job, but he's just, you know, he's nothing next to Sherlock Holmes, and he always needs his help.
He's doing other stuff, right? Like he's suppressing
that too. Yeah, he's got a lot of stuff to do. Yes,
strike breaker more than anything else.
In 1890s, yeah.
He's like, you know, he's a strike breaker first, and a riot, or basically a. They are law and order keeping.
Social order maintainers. Yeah. Well, not even law per se necessarily, right?
Yeah.
but social order. And when that, you know, conflicts with the law, oh well. Or a certain vision of, you know, someone's vision of social order. And but the point is that, yeah, so you had this kind of investigatory function about serious crimes. But other than that, it would, you know, if you saw someone do the stealing, then maybe you would, you know, catch them. But if you didn't,
it was like, but it was also like, if you saw it as a citizen, you had a duty to stop that.
Yes. Yes.
In the same way.
Yes. And you wouldn't get sued for beating someone up for trying to steal your
tracks with also like firefighting too. Like if you saw a fire, you had an obligation to like, oh fuck, I have to go. Like we must all now form a bucket brigade now. And there might be a fire.
Okay. So I have a
fire marshal in the town.
I know you mentioned this in your initial pitch for this episode, about firemen, and I wanted to talk. Okay, so I am now, you know, increasingly familiar with like little kids cartoons and stuff that because, you know, got little kids, and there's a show on Netflix, an animated series, which I've actually had this like hot take buried for a while. I don't know how. I have to like poke more into it or something, but it's called Fireman Sam, right? And it's interesting because the I was like, it has to be some kind of, I thought it might have been like Danish or something, but it's Welsh, and it's basically like the ethno state. There are some non-whites, and I guess they have a bunch of seasons, and of course there's more non-whites as it goes on, but basically it's close to the end, all the little kids and the little mischievous kid who really gets in a lot of trouble all the time, and he causes all these problems mainly through his narcissism and overinflated ego and just kind of generally being a very annoying bratty little kid, is extremely Jewy and is like, he like talked in this kind of nebbishy little voice, and he has this basically like an 11-year-old Woody Allen type character, which I find just absolutely fucking hilarious. So the show is quite interesting in those ways. But the reason I'm bringing it up beyond just sort of, you know, if you have kids or you will, you know, have shortly, for whom it's relevant, this is not, I think, the worst media to consume. Well, it's kind of like, so I was talking about this with Mrs. DK, right? Because she was like, why, you know, I don't love the show, because what's the content, what's the actual, like, what's actually going on? And it's true, in a given episode, it's like cat stuck in a tree, you know, call the fire. I believe that's the jingle. It's like when he hears that fire alarm, Sam is always cool and calm. Basically the idea is like, he's just, and he Sam is the tagline is Sam is the hero next door. And it's this idea. It's obviously, you know, completely, well, it's just, I guess that's why we're talking about it, but it's very much like the fireman as, you know, the hero next door, who, when you have a cat stuck in a tree, when your Jewy archetype, you know, tries to cut corners in the treehouse, and suddenly the treehouse is like tilting over and everyone's stuck in the treehouse, like, who are you going to call? Fireman Sam.
When you're too obese to leave your house without a crane.
Right. Exactly. But her objection was essentially, well, first of all, it's just like these kids are getting in danger and then they get rescued. Like, who cares? I'm like, well, I mean, you know, but it's his job. You know, he's like, that's what he's there for. I thought about it for a second. I said, well, the idea is it's like, that's just the kind of guy Sam is, you know, he's the kind of guy who would rescue you from a fire on a purely volunteer basis. It's just, you know, that's his job. Which it speaks to, again, I don't know. I don't have anything. It's interesting, I guess, that firemen have been largely,
well, these both fire and police, spared. Like, they're both voluntary. They're both like professionalizations of what was a volunteer task that all men were
right
to do. Like,
to do even some, yeah, up until, when the need arose
very recently. Like, I think I've heard of even my grandparents and slightly younger, like, talking about, like, oh, well, there was a fire here, so we had to, like, get our hose. Like, if the neighbor's house caught fire, you would spray it with your hose until, like, the real fire department came. But, like, you were supposed to jump in and do something. You weren't, like, just going to look. And now the idea that you see a fire, maybe you go in, try to save somebody, try to open a door, but the idea that you start trying to put the fire out yourself when you see your neighbor's house on fire, I mean, I'd like to think I would do that, but that's not really a thing people expect to do ever, right?
Right. No, not at all.
And to the same thing, arguably, with, you know, criminality. And of course, firemen have been spared this because, like, their job hasn't changed, right? Because post-World War II, the police's job is to, like, investigate crimes and keep, you know, black people away from white neighborhoods in urban
areas. Actually think the real that's certainly true, and I think it speaks to the broader professionalization across pretty much, I mean, just all of post-industrial society, especially in with the United States leading the way across the post-industrial world. I mean, everything from really even professors. I mean, you had obviously like a university system, well, in principle, going back to Oxford and the Sorbonne and so on in the Middle Ages, but really it's an 18th, 19th century institution. But even though you would have had, like, you know, people appointed, it was still very much a kind of, you know, if you were already a wealthy, you know, landed, essentially nobility, you kind of engaged in science or whatever for fun and on the side, and then you would, you know, get a professorship as, you know, this guy has kind of done this for a while. It was not
famously, like, you could become a lawyer in the US by buying law textbooks.
Yeah, I mean, right. Well, yes, of course, the legal profession absolutely is one of the, you know, most sort of on dubiously efficacious grounds, professionalized to enormous extent over that time span. So yeah, and that started, I guess, in Law's case a little earlier, probably in, like, yeah, that, like, 1920s, 1930s. Although you still had, yes, I mean, and I think California now is the only state where you don't need an accredited 3-year degree, which, you know, well, I could go on. It doesn't matter.
There's a few, actually. I think it's Virginia as well. You can take law apprenticeships still. They're on the books.
Okay.
You've got to be a
That's also rare. In most of the rest of the world, it's essentially an undergraduate degree, and then you do an apprenticeship, and then you're, you know, of course, there's other reasons for that as well, but all of these kinds of things, so many doctors, obviously, you know, we're mostly just kind of, they were, talk about social prestige and an inversion. You know, doctors used to be regarded as quacks, as sort of inherently suspicious characters, which often they were. The professionalization of medicine, I know that, what was that HBO or Showtime show? I know there was a, I never saw
Nick,
it, but there was
the Nick.
Maybe, I don't remember that, but I know there was a program that sort of chronicled that crucial period where the translation from literal snake oil salesman to it was a big controversy at the time, you know, washing your hands. This is one bit of history that's true that I know, is, you know, that the that it was essentially actively debated, you know, should you wash your hands before surgery or not? And it was the I forget his name, but the guy who insisted on it was only vindicated after his death that, yeah, dumb ass retards, wash your hands. So that was, yeah, it was all of these things really kicked up over the course of the 20th century and especially after the Second World War. But I do think, with regard to police in particular, that the relevant date is not whatever, May, whatever, 1945, it's September 11th, 2001. I think that really marks, as in so much of American life, the transition point where police really started becoming, I mean, that is, you know, talk about this sort of interesting intertwined relationship between military and police, but that's really where the police became militarized in the sense of acquiring and deploying military hardware.
So I think you're placing it optimistically late. The police were doing like LAPD shit in the 90s.
That's true. SWAT. Yeah, that's true.
Like taking APCs and like driving them through walls for drug raids, you know, and having helicopters and things. Like, I don't think militarization actually, people really care about it. I think it's kind of a meme to care about. But you actually
people care guilty, I suppose. Yeah,
but people caring that the cops have like APCs and rifles instead of shotguns and like, you know, and like cruisers. It's just a one more thing to piss at the police that you're allowed to be pissed about. Like, what people are pissed at the police at is that they don't solve crimes anymore. Like, if you get robbed and you call the police, they make a note of it for your insurance company. That's all they right. do, and that's. And most times your insurance company doesn't cover it because it's less than.
Why would your, yeah, it's like, yeah, exactly. It's not going to, yeah.
So, and they don't, if you see a black person in your neighborhood and you call the police, they don't do shit. So what, pray tell, are we doing here? Like, yeah. What is this?
Hey man, those donuts aren't going to eat themselves.
The police have a million and a half ass jobs, right? Like, they half ass all of their jobs except for like ticketing white people. They don't actually suppress.
There's also
like,
civil asset forfeiture.
They don't actually suppress like criminal enterprises, right? They just don't. Like, it's almost comical. Their cope is that there's too many rights and things, and I just don't see it. Like, there are neighborhoods in America that are pretty like well maintained. Like, I remember visiting my cousins once, and they were at a pretty upscale place, and they're like, "Oh yeah, the neighbor down the block and a half that way, they have a meth lab in the basement, and everyone knows about it." And like, that's not weird, but the police just like, "Oh well, you know, can't go in." Like, they're just kind of lazy. They don't do much. They increasingly just enforce fees, and the prestige is falling because people don't view them as connected anything. And like and that was even before the whole like defund the police and the police falling back from society. Like, the idea that the number one hating police or disliking police demographic is like young right wing men would astound somebody from like born in 1950, right? Like, oh yeah, no, the whole libertarian movement is less about marijuana and more about like, honestly, like teenage white guys getting tickets for speeding. That's what it's about. Like, that's how it starts, because that's your interaction with police. It's not this, you know, just waving like so if you're say like someone like George W. Bush, right? Your interactions with the police, and not in him, but like of his era, is that your interaction with the cop is that you were drunk after in college and they give you a ride home, right? They pulled you over and like drove you to your house. And now if you're speeding, you owe them $500. And like, yeah, oh well, like the interaction with police for young men has now dramatically changed, and the prestige dropped when those people kind of more come of age. And I think, like, there's no real solution to this. I don't think the prestige, you can't really increase the prestige of a job consciously. It has to just come back through, you know, policy shifts. And I think the interactions and the assumed competence, because even if cops aren't all kind of retarded, like malicious retards, like they get painted, it's almost a, like, giving them an out. To say, oh, they're just malicious retards. Like, well, why can't, when my car gets busted into and hit my radio, why can't the police find the guy who did it? It's like, well, if he's a malicious retard, it makes a certain amount of sense. If he's actively capable of solving that crime and is refusing to do it, that's a much more, like, deep indictment of the profession and the system. So like if you're a police inspector, which most people here aren't because of like our politics, you have to wonder like are they like incapable or are they malicious retards? And I think most people think of like, oh, they're just retarded and kind of somewhat mean-spirited people as a less offensive like concept. Like it damages most people's worldview and faith in America less if they just view the police as a bit slow and mean-spirited than if they view them as like good men who are just like intelligent but profoundly bad at their jobs. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. I guess I don't know what police people do all day. I know they drive around in cars sometimes.
Isn't that the question though, right? Like, isn't that the question? I know federal agents do. It's mostly
Right. But what does your local PD do? Because yeah, as you say, they're certainly not like, you know, chasing break-ins. They'll show up a couple hours after a crime has been committed, or they'll take your statement about it. So as you know, what is it you would say you do here? I don't know. Yeah.
A lot of what they do is just like it's just playing referee for low class, even whites, like low class whites and low class other races. It's just like being called to like referee a domestic dispute or like.
Wellness checks and domestic like disturbance calls. Yeah.
And that's that kind of stuff. Like, but that's not like really productive. Like, in any way, like the average person who's not like in that, I don't know, call it like heavy user of police resources band, is just constantly victimized by the police. And yeah, the average person.
Yeah, their main interaction is getting a traffic ticket. That's certainly been my experience. That's like the most I've ever interacted with police over my lifetime, for sure, has pretty much exclusively has been, other than, you know, maybe to say like hi or something. I would have to think about it.
I have someone who's hosted some large parties on the weekend. You know, I have been like talking them down.
Noise complaint. Yeah.
Yeah, like
hey, I have been at a party where that happened, but I have never thrown a party where that happened.
Yes, so. But like, and we were.
I don't know if that counts as an interaction with the police. Yeah.
Yeah, but like, it's like talking to the cops, like, "Hey, don't fuck this up. Like, we are not being left. Like, I don't know what you want me to do. Like, the music's inside. We are outside, and we can't hear it. So what the fuck? Like, but like, it's always like, oh fuck, these guys could just ruin everything if they want to, because like somebody called and. You know?
Yeah.
And so I want to get off the police, but I want to give that as an example of like the most, I think usually we're going to chart how something has increased or decreased in prestige. And maybe, but this was like the most, they went from the mountaintops of like the golden era and now they're at like, oh, like what do they even do here? Like, you know? And of course, like, white people don't like them for this reason, and blacks don't like them because like they're obviously still constantly interacting with them in a way they don't like either, you know? So it's
occasionally serve a warrant or you know, catch most a crime in commission.
That's the thing, is they don't serve warrants anymore. They just wait for that person to get picked
up.
Maybe
you're not allowed to after Breonna Taylor, Saint Breonna Taylor.
I'm sure it happens that they serve warrants, but generally the way a warrant is served is this person is given a warrant, it's out, and you wait till that person gets arrested for another crime. And then you get them with the warrant. Like, oh, this person committed this crime.
Yeah, they were out. Yes, right, sure. You have outstanding warrants for this, that, and the other. I see that a lot. That's pretty much always, it's outstanding warrants.
People have outstanding warrants.
POWs, yes. That's great. All the time when you like these, you know, one of these infuriating news story about black victimizer of innocent white person, get excited for consuming more of the same. But it's pretty much inevitable that, you know, when the black victimizer is arrested in the article, is described, they're described as, you know, also has warrants for X, Y, and Z for sure. They see that all the time.
And to shift the fireman, just to kind of finish that out, is the
fireman. Or convictions. I guess you have warrants, or you have, sometimes it's warrants, sometimes it's convictions.
Yeah. Well, and shooting as a fireman, firemen are still at that peak. If anything, it's accelerated, like post at 9/11, because obviously a bunch of them died in 9/11. But like,
so the other interesting thing about firemen as a job is, it's been a kind of hot potato in terms of the affirmative action thing. I believe it was in Connecticut. I'd have to double check. I believe it was in Connecticut. It doesn't really matter. Of, you know, they had, it was essentially, they had a test. Like, you have to have certain minimum IQ threshold essentially to be a good fireman. Duh. And, so the, there weren't enough blacks, of course, so they got rid of the test, but still had that particular test, but still had some other kind of filtration mechanism. And anyway, the end result was it's been in a way that policing really hasn't, because I know the TDS guys mention all the time how basically every police chief in a metro area in the United States is a black woman. It's kind of funny, and like, why, you know, but whatever, it's just, it, there's no, like, the policeman who beat up that the guy in Colorado, whatever, there was they were trying to do another George Floyd, you know, one of these and I think it turned out most likely that one of the police officers who participated in the beating was, I guess, married to someone. He was being cuckolded essentially by the guy they killed, they beat up to, you know, beat to death. So it probably, I mean, I guess you could say that's kind of a racial motive to an extent, but not, you know, whatever. But the, there's obviously, like, there's no issue, like, whatever it is, whatever function it is that police are doing, it's, they have no problem acquiring enough blacks to do it to a degree that they find internally satisfactory. The same is not true of firefighters, which I find interesting.
Yes, but like, I don't even like as much affirmative action. The firemen could be incompetent, and you would never know, right? You know, like, the firemen could be malicious retards, and you would never have any.
I mean, I feel like an incompetent fireman would just get killed at a certain point, you know, or something. Yeah. Like, I don't. Well, like, that could be wrong. I just,
like, it's like, how would I know? Like, oh, that
thing. Yeah, yeah, that certainly is true. Yeah.
What am I gonna fucking check their note? Like, check their.
I think it's very much. I think it's more of like a, what is it, the McNamara's morons or whatever. What was the you know, the Vietnam thing, yeah, where they tried to, they lowered the IQ to serve, and basically they got killed and or just got a bunch of other people killed. Like, I feel like it was more slot in, like, that.
There's a joke
I could be wrong.
Workshopping for stand up that 9/11 was the greatest failure of American firefighters in history. It's an extremely epic joke. Like, you call this like their greatest day? Like, there's no fucking building left, guy. But
yeah,
obviously, you know, the jokes. I will polish that into a good joke one of these days. But
it's no longer too soon, which helps.
Yeah, but it points to how, like, how do you judge, like, a good versus bad job? It's like, and who fundamentally, yeah, really cares?
For
and,
sure.
And I want to change gears into other, you know, other questions. I have another thing I wanted to bring up with you. What we talked about is the idea of, like, janitors and custodians. Like, the idea of it being a, it's never been a prestigious job, right? But groundskeeper, custodian was like a trusted member of somebody's, of a household or a business. They were, yeah, assumed to be pretty intelligent. If you read World War One,
management would almost invariably side, for sure, like, you know, in a dispute with whomever, you know, that would be, yeah, their guy who had been there for 30, 40 years. Yeah.
Yeah. If you read a World War One memoir, if you mention a guy being a groundskeeper, it's like, oh, this was like a competent guy. Like, he, like, before the war, he was a groundskeeper because, like, on, you know, estates would have one. And who would, like, oh, he was past familiar with a lot of things. He's, you know, generally an intelligent job. And that increased as, like, as buildings got larger and companies got larger. And, like, the guy at an office building who keeps the furnace running and the AC and the HVAC, all the stuff, and the electrical stuff, who would be doing basic preventative maintenance by himself, would not necessarily need a high school education, probably had one, could be assumed to be reasonably competent, that person is kind of gone, right? It's been replaced with this idea of a person who just like kind of like sweeps up and throws the garbage away. And so much that even like the person and the stereotype has been in a place like there is the last like I don't know, media depiction of a janitor is like The Simpsons. And it's like and it's an anachronism with Gerald Heber Willie, who's like the janitor of the school. But the idea of like, and of course,
well, it was an anachronism when the show launched in 1989 or whatever. Yeah. It was an anachronism, right? Yeah. It's not just like an
But the idea like of like now it's like a bunch of generally like, you know, South American women who do the cleaning, and no one does preventative maintenance. There's not a the idea of your building or your institution having a preventative maintenance guy is gone. And it used to be a job that was like very valued and should be. And I think it's really kind of, its decline is an indicator of American decline. Part of it was that that people, those jobs, you know, as prestige generally rose, you know, in the post-World War II era, the prestige and compensation for these jobs didn't increase. And like, yeah, like a lot of institutions were priced out of hiring a competent white guy for this job when he could go be a plumber and make so much more money, you know, like these institutions didn't really pay much, and perhaps they should have. Maybe they would have saved more money over the long term. But I've always had this theory that you could measure a society based on the competence of their like custodial staff, like if they're going up or down. And I think I had you push back a little bit, but like I said, you could have pulled the in like the height of it, you at NASA during the Apollo missions, if you pulled the janitor out of the building, you could have, you with a couple months of training, you could have replaced one of the astronauts with that guy, you know. And now that's like unheard of, but if he's just a reasonably competent white guy, probably served World War II, he could probably like sit in this rocket and be trusted to like maybe fix some electronics if he had to, you know. Now it's like, you're really pushing it with that, you know.
I would like to think that NASA would hire 115 IQ janitors, so I'm gonna say yeah, you know. I get what you're saying in any case, you know, like I think it's a validation of the kind of general point that you could understand, you know, how and why. I'm not saying they were. I have no idea. It's an interesting question, maybe, to, you know, how would you even measure? But you could understand why you would want 115 IQ janitor. And Charles Murray talks about this in The Bell Curve. I mean, mainly, you know, people ever always, you know, it in our spheres and generally, it's mainly remembered for just laying out in very blunt factual terms the standard deviation gap between black and white IQ on average. But really that's not even really what the book is about. It's sort of just, it's relevant and it comes up and it's dealt with to some extent, but fundamentally the book is about the shift really in American society and the American economy generally, where you used to have, okay, yes, you know, high IQ people tend to do better for themselves, tend to have higher IQ children. Those children tend to start with more advantages and also tend to be higher IQ. So, and you do, you always have, you know, the idiot son of the local, you know, magnate or whatever, but that's a media Jewy kind of representation of, you know, or distortion really of an underlying reality that to some extent there's a natural, you know, the smarter farmer tends to have the bigger, has the farm that does better, that grows better, that, you know, leaves more for his children and so on, and in a virtuous cycle. So the thing is that in American society up to around the Second World, or basically up to the Second World War, and that you had a much wider mix of, because you had more high IQ people just in all kinds of different professions and all kinds of social settings. You had, yes, 150 and maybe even 130 IQ janitors and car mechanics and plumbers and so on. And you know, I'm sure there's some, it's an interesting kind of failure of the American education system that you don't tell someone with 130 IQ like, hey, if you become a really good plumber, you can own your own plumbing business and become a plumbing, you know, like you have the brain, you know, you don't, there's no reason for you to go to a 4-year, college or whatever in the current year. That's just a waste of your time. And some people are, you know, people are starting to get that message to some extent, but you had a much, I think that the reason why I mentioned this ultimately is because I think prestige at some level, as we're kind of defining it in these, or whatever, exploring it in these extremely broad terms. I think pro-sociality is kind of baked in there. It has to be, because prestige is a social mechanism. And so society is going to reward certain classes of people within it with what you could call prestige. So then the question is like, okay, what kinds of people are going to be rewarded with this almost like a currency, and for what, and why, and for what reasons, for accomplishing what?
I want to get to, you're getting one of my right huge points, is that in a good society, prestige is like, it's not aligned with money. That makes sense. Like, not necessarily.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, it's almost a substitute.
That would be usurious, right? in the Aristotelian, like, original sense of, like, you're putting the, like, yeah, absolutely.
Like, a prestige should be in lieu of actual compensation and not alongside it. And like, the fall of America is 110% the fact that we've aligned like money making with prestige, like 100%. Like, who's the most prestigious lawyer? What's the most prestigious law firm in the United States? It's the most one with the biggest money, right? Like, that's like the top 10 law firms in America, kind of like how they calculate top 10, 100 is like how much money they make, right?
The top 10 universities are the universities with the biggest endowments. You know, I mean, yes, you can. And there used to be an argument that, like, okay, well, they had the biggest endowments because they had the best, you know, matriculants, because they had the best professors. And there was an extent to which that used to be true. Anyone who tells you with a straight face that, you know, oh, Harvard is, you know, the number one university in the world because of the quality of the scholarship that's produced by Harvard professors is just lying. They're just, I mean, they're just like, anyone who doesn't know better is just, is just lying. Like, it's really simple. And the same is true, you know, up and down the American university system, is that it's coasting on.
Well, you are shifting gear for me, is that the idea of a professor has, like, absolutely dropped in prestige. Like, it used to be like, this guy speaks Latin and Greek, even if he's like a physics professor.
Right.
And like, yes. In 1900, he speaks Latin and Greek. It doesn't matter what he's professor of, he speaks Latin and Greek. And now it's like, holy shit, this
person. Well, these people are idiots, right? Yeah, it's
both prestige and money, right? They don't get either. Like, there was a window where they.
Well, this is the thing, man. I mean, the natural sciences are a little, you know. I do want to. It's and it's not even so much that. I think even the natural sciences these days, like, the people on the extreme right of the bell curve tend to stay away from that for a lot of reasons, not the least of which is you just do better in the private sector. So there's definitely, but it's not that, you have to do poorly as a professor. It's, I think, really just the institution of science is what gets called science in the press. You know, it's just the idea that if you can, like, run a linear regression on a data set, that therefore you are a scientist, is sort of, consumed, I don't know, so much of what passes for American intellectual life. And yeah, it's really pathetic. It's and interesting, like, that the as you said,
they teach at their professor, like, I don't know what that means to a degree. Like, you teach at college, like,
right,
like, that, yeah, really just, like, there's no, like, the prerequisite, the not that it's been a bad thing necessarily for how a system should work, but like, the prerequisites of that are kind of gone. Like, you just, like, you just teach a class. Like, you could be a master's student and be teaching a class at a university, right? Like,
yes,
you know, if you're teaching algebra 1 at a state college, like, not that that's not an important job, but like,
or you could be a language instructor. I mean, there's any number of
low barrier
things that yeah, don't, but it, but yeah, it's Spanish, sorry,
you could probably get a job at a university, like, teaching Spanish, like,
If you're like, I mean, big, you know, you're married schools to one of the other professors, maybe.
The demand at big state schools is pretty brutal for, like, because everyone has to take a language usually, usually it's Spanish. I know people who are, you know, well, they say it's like self-perpetuating, right? It's like, well, I got a Spanish major, so therefore I'm a professor, because like they're in Spanish majors are in demand to teach Spanish, because universities need to crank out a lot of.
That's extremely depressing. I was not aware of that. Holy crap.
Yeah. I mean,
that's awful. I did not know that.
Yeah. When I was at university, I don't think I ever had a Spanish professor who had a PhD. Yep.
No, that's common for language instruction to not have those are like the least. Yeah, you would typically be.
And I had one who was married to a real professor one too.
That's the
at my university, the language it was a joke. Like it was they didn't have any flexibility. They were forced to teach out of a true syllabus, like on day whatever we're doing.
Because you're just like you're just a cog in a machine. I mean, you are anyway as a professor. I don't want to get too far off track on this thing, but
true. In terms of what a professor does is they don't actually do much. It doesn't seem like they don't do papers and stuff, but academic journals have become like this very safe, like away from everything thing where you just like put it and now it's on JSTOR and no one ever like it's.
Oh, if you get like 20 citations of like literally if you get 20 people who cite your work, it's enormous. That's like a huge deal that if it comes up like 20 times. For the humanities, especially, even in the natural sciences, it's not a whole. I mean, the standards are a little different, and the way it works is a little different. Like what counts as a citation of you, that's the thing is I think the as you say, prestige is something that is something that society compensates certain of its members with in lieu of essentially financial compensation. Used to be, you know, like obviously in the classical world, virtue was like the thing, you know, society gives you prestige for virtue. Now that's not necessarily like, you know, some kind of Christian virtue in the sense, you know, for the Romans in particular, it was very, nationalistic and militaristic. Not that I think that's a bad thing. I'm just, you know, it's not quite the same thing as in a kind of more Christian / potentially Aristotelian sense of.
Even in like the old South, aristocratic families that own plantations would have a lot of money. But not as much as, say, someone who owned a factory in the North.
Oh, like everyone
was like, I don't want to be the factory guy. I want to own a plantation. Right.
I want to associate with the plantation owner and his son and his daughter and blah, blah, blah.
And I want duels and matters of honor and these things. Like, no one's like, oh, I really want to enslave Irishmen at the shoe factory.
Like, yeah.
Like,
I guess part of it's interesting that professors are now in this kind of, or, you know, the, let's say education professionals broadly, because I think despite that there are certain, I'll get to that in a second, but yes, let's lump for now, especially, public high school teachers in with university professors, because I think they're really increasingly in the same boat, which is funny because pretty much every university professor is a university professor because they wanted to do something more prestigious than a public high school teacher. Private, I guess even.
It's not even a hot take, but like if I was talking to somebody and they said, oh, I teach like American history at a high school versus I teach American history at college.
Yeah.
I would get a better quality of individual and conversation out of the high school teacher.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Anyone disagrees. Like,
yeah,
because they're just better folks. I don't know how to explain it. High school are kind of cool and have like they have cool niche interests and like they can be into ancient Rome without being gauche. You know, like if somebody's like a history professor or college,
they have a lot. Rome, yeah, it's
you know, it's like oh, that's kind of gauche. That's a little bit. It's kind of normie guy. But like, I'm actually into Latinx faggots in the 1700s in the Caribbean. Like, wow, no one gives a fuck. Like, no one.
There was a tweet like yesterday, the day before, by God Closed My Eyes, who I'm back on Twitter, sort of surreptitiously, just you know, testing the waters. And that was a guy from like way back, I believe it was from him. Anyway. But it was noting that there's a new faggotology because the first faggotology was literally called that. It was like in the title of the dissertation, I think at Princeton. Yeah, it was like a literal faggotology of Black Caribbean faggots. But then there was celebrating a tweet. I think it was Cal Berkeley. There was someone who, oh, he just got a, he got awarded a dissertation fellowship, which is like a $30,000-$40,000 grant, work on his dissertation concerning visuality and masculinity in Black thug pornography. Which I take it to be a homosexual. So he's literally like watching like nigger faggot porn, like, and getting paid $40,000 to write about it.
Each reference, like in this, like, the most famous like lemur of this stuff. That's
yeah. So that's, ladies and gentlemen, I present to you, you know, the American Academy, its most prestigious public university. Yeah.
Yeah, like talk about like
university fans like stay eternally butthurt.
The whole Cal U system is fucked.
Like, yeah, no, it's. I mean, they don't have money. Whatever. I don't even want. Again, I don't want to go too far like, down this road. It's just like
Cal universities were considered like, oh, that's the, like of all the state systems, so that's the best one.
That's what Tomorrowland was like, the whole Walt Disney futurist like techno thing that was essentially that was reflected. Stanford was founded by a eugenicist. That's one of like Steve Saylor's most hilarious bits, I find, is like he loves to remind people it was a dude who was really into racehorses and people like breeding programs. Yeah. And
even Caltech, which is the best, I think was probably predicted to like surpass MIT and kind of never has. And kind of that is part of being part of the California system, and that, you know, which sucks, you know. But not that, yeah, Caltech's great. Obviously, it's a great university, but like, it's not.
I think that actually has more to do with prestige. I think that, I mean, it could be. I think there's some, Caltech tends to attract more kind of pure, like, well, essentially your bookish Asian stereotype, like that has a trouble, you know, fitting to some extent. It's real, like this whole thing about affirmative action and like, you know, Ivy League Caltech things and blah blah blah. We don't want too many Asians, like. That's the thing, is essentially it's a pure, they've made some noises about, but they're just not, they have the few token blacks and they're just like, whatever, we don't care, that's not what we're here for. And and it's pretty much all you know, perfect set.
They need five,
I guess. Yeah, but yeah, right. But no, MIT has like, you know, big boy, or at least had big boy humanities programs, and that East Coast cachet yeah, the Cal, you know, anyway, but yeah, it's an interesting question. Like, why is MIT still in some way more prestigious than Caltech? I think part of it is that it's older. I think part, or the idea of it is older, you know, that I don't know what in what form. I know MIT has history going back long way. So it's I think there's an interesting sense in which institute.
You want a hot take on MIT?
Yeah.
Then? It's
all right
because it's not an Ivy League, but it is, and therefore it's the least Jewish Ivy.
Well, it's certainly the most meritocratic, and certainly, you know, Ivies. Yeah.
And it's not Ivy per se, but it is. Everyone knows this.
Well, right, I mean, no one's gonna, yeah, right.
It's the Gentile Ivy League.
The kind of guy who, like, I went to an Ivy League school is the kind of, like, he went to Cornell. If someone says that, they went to Cornell. Anyway, yeah, okay, so the kind of broad, okay, I think that's true, which is interesting, but I think it's also, I do think there's something to the idea that prestige accrues over time, like interest, maybe, to an extent, right? Like the individuals and institutions that are older are more prestigious, and that's not just true, obviously, that's like an anthropological universal.
The modern concept is like a brand, right? A brand is effectively just like,
Commodification. Oh my god, it makes me want to scream. Yes, of course.
But yeah, it's just, yeah, it's like, it's like a endorsement, right? Like, well, this person who's coming to fix your fucking Wi-Fi is from Comcast. Like, oh god, oh fuck, right? Like, this is gonna suck. You know, versus this person coming from like Bell, a reference my parents used. You could assume like a Bell person was competent. And it's kind of like, obviously it's totally unfair. A Comcast tech could be totally competent and a Bell tech could be, you know, retarded and fuck up your stuff. But it was like this
it's just, it's effectively a stereotype. It's racism for jobs, right? Like at the end of the day, it's pattern recognition.
Well, it depends on what the brand, I mean, that gets into stuff, which I don't know. I've always been allergic to like marketing and communications and all the whole, like, it just gives me hives. I can't, but yes, as I understand it, it's a question of brand perception.
Prestigious, really, at a certain
yeah, point. Yeah. No, absolutely.
This person but then is an officer in the British Army, therefore they won't fuck me out of this whatever deal we're doing here, you know? Like, they're an honest broker because he holds the King's Commission as an officer in the British Army. There's not, yes, it's different than a brand, because but like, it's not that much different. And the way you get that is through, you know, not lying. And when people, like, break that rule, you, like, kill them, right? Like, or you
Take
them out.
You strip them of their whatever. Yes.
Yeah. As we're going into prestige, I want to get into like the idea of military officers and enlisted as a prestigious thing to be, because being a military enlisted man was until World War One, like, one of the worst and dirty, dishonorable things you could be was a non-officer in any military. Absolutely dog shit job. No prestige. You had no pension if you got hurt, really. It was pennies, usually. They were just constantly fucked over because they were expensive to maintain. Even though they didn't get paid shit, there were so many of them during a war. It just, like, drains the money of these tiny... Because the size of states was relatively small, and it would just drain the treasuries. So they were disliked by the government. They were, like, obviously, like, flogging, you could flog soldiers until hilariously recently. You could, like, post-slavery, you could flog soldiers. And World War One and the draft coming back really brought it back around. And also, this kind of hating soldiers is an Anglosphere thing, like enlisted soldiers, because the rest of the world embraced the draft much earlier and just got over it. Like, the draft is what makes soldiers, if not prestigious, like, oh, they're just everybody else. Like, it's not even your job. It's like the thing you are forced to do. But the Anglosphere didn't really do any kind of organized, massive, you know, civilizational draft until World War One. And, you know, soldiers have been riding that high for a while. And then World War Two happened, and like the mythology during the war, they were still like treated kind of like dog shit. But after, you get the mythologizing, and the GI Bill was like kind of to make up for maybe they weren't treated so great during the war. So you get GI Bill, you get all this other stuff, and it becomes like becoming a soldier becomes a thing you can do that doesn't like that is like, oh, that's actually a positive. Like, you know, this person earned their college degree as opposed to getting it through a student loan or whatever, and all these things that aren't necessarily true. I think it's probably gone too far into the worship side, and then 9/11 and then what's funny is when we went to a professional military, technology had made it to where you couldn't have like a bunch of criminals and retards and drunks in your professional army like it used to be. Like, it used to be that was for immigrants and criminals and indigent people. They used to recruit out of orphanages. That was a very open thing. It's like, well, you've turned like 15 in an orphanage and no one adopted you yet, so you're in the whatever Anglosphere country army that's closest, right? And now it's a relatively prestigious job. And I think that's it. That's interesting. And it got more prestigious as it got professionalized, because like the minimum standards had to be stay that way. And it's the one job where we talk about like prestige in lieu of money, where the government has like made, there has been a social conditioning operation post 9/11 to increase the prestige of this job. Like, because they're not going to increase the pay, because you can't, there's too many. There's almost 2 million soldiers, I believe, right? Or damn near it. Yeah, it's like 1.6 million people, like, in the Department of Defense. You can't pay them more, because it's exponential. It gets insane. And they're not paid terribly. But the government is, like, literally trying to push prestige. And, of course, as the credibility of the U.S. government has decreased, its ability to push prestige into this job has decreased. And I don't think that the prestige is necessarily lost. People don't look down on the job, but the job has kept its prestige. Like, if you say you were in the army, people say, oh, that's cool, that's great, I respect you, thank you for your service. But if you it's no longer aspirational, right? Like, people don't want to be soldiers at the rates they used to, you know? So, like, it's lost the aspirational aspect, but not the, I guess it's like some, there's some lingering prestige. Like, it's more prestigious almost to have used to been in the military than it used, than it is to be as an enlisted man, which is, I think, very funny. What do you think of that, TK?
Yeah, I think definitely there's, you'd help clarify something for me, which was this definite shift in media representations of soldiers during the First World War, in especially not so much in the United States, but in England, and in English literature and so on. There's definitely the way people talk about soldiers as yeah, like Johnny from the village who got torn apart by machine guns versus Johnny from the village who got stabbed to death in the Hindu Kush, but I don't care really because like Johnny was kind of a shithead and, you know, the joining the British Army was a way for him to
not be hung.
Not, yeah. Yeah. Or just not be a drunk or both or whatever. Right.
Yeah.
That's definitely like a kind of big picture noticeable shift in English language media.
Notably Rudyard Kipling, who was the guy who he was like the weirdo who liked soldiers before it was cool.
Before it was cool. Know? Yeah, exactly. Yes. And exactly.
And that kind of explained, I think, his fame in a lot of ways is like as soldiers became cool and respected, he had this body of work that was like pro them and happy and like not happy necessarily. It showed like the hardships, but you know, it was an expression of those like of what they were and that became popular, and therefore he, you know, made a lot of money, right? As because of course, like paying poets got democratized over the same period as the military. So
poetry became professionalized as the. I mean, that's the interesting thing.
Professionalized, but I think it was the idea. It was like instead of being a patron who was a professional, the individual people could compensate you by buying a book, which was new, I think.
Yes. And yeah, I mean, that's a whole thing you could do just on. I mean, I've spent actually a lot of time over the years thinking about exactly this question I think it's pretty much the same thing in the case of especially the humanities, but also really to some extent, to a large extent, even the natural science. I mean, you know, scientists at the origins of what we would call science and the scientific method were literally just like wealthy single men who would put various acids on their tongue and describe the taste. And this is like a way ultimately to get at its chemical structure. You know, it's, I mean, the, you know, the institution has changed a lot by being professionalized, by being industrialized or brought into the industrial economy by means of this mechanism. In science is a little different because that's all, you know, that's going to be tied to engineering and industry in a way that, you know, literature and philosophy and so on just can't and won't. But you see the same, although, you know, in those cases, it's mass media and like the idea of a public intellectual or someone who would acquire. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, I guess, the question of, you know, what makes an academic prestigious is a whole other thing, but you definitely see the shift in how people are like what the mechanisms of capitalism in the 20th and 21st centuries, how they operate to like provide compensation on a kind of industrial model to fine things like fine art, you know, fine arts and the idea of like a an orchestra, right? An orchestra used to be like literally you're a wealthy, you know, you're a Medici or something, and you just, you want to throw a party, you have an or, you know, there's, and there's, you know, traveling musicians and musicians who are maybe a little more less traveling or whatever, but typically, you know, especially for the people who are really into music, you would just essentially like hire people. I mean, you would literally, there'd be like employees on a, you know, long-term basis. Mendelssohn, I believe when he was 14, was given an or like his family was, you know, wealthy. I believe he was Jewish, but anyway, his father was like, here, this is an orchestra that will do whatever you tell them. Have fun. And he started like writing symphonies, right?
Well, also, so it was a part-time job for the musicians usually. It wasn't like their full-time gig.
Right. And it wasn't a career in that kind of a sense. Yes.
Yeah. And
yeah, this career is it. But then how are you going to get, you know, of course, then it's like a different set of calculations, but now it's like, well, how am I going to get healthcare? You know, how am I going to interact with the capitalist system to avoid precarity? And yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's the fine arts have become, the fine arts and the humanities and all these kinds of squishier areas of human intellectual life are, have been really, largely destroyed by the shift, I would say, for sure. Yeah. And I guess with the concomitant loss of prestige.
So I kind of was bringing part to democratization. I want to think of how the most recent, I don't know, it's called prestige loss, is actually in. So obviously, actors have had a meteoric rise in prestige since 1900. Like, absolutely.
Okay. That was the last thing. Maybe the last thing I wanted. That was something I wanted to talk about, and that's a good, great place to end it. Because like the whole, I was thinking about. Go on. We'll do that, and then we'll close it there.
Military, all right. We're gonna do that last. We can close with that. I want to cover military officers first, because the officer thing is, if not the inverse of the enlisted thing, it's very. I think it's almost more interesting though, because being an officer in the military used to be like the most prestigious job in society. Effectively, like holding a commission, you had to have a paper signed by the head of state to hold the job, right? Very few jobs had that. The pay wasn't great for comparable things you could be doing as a, you know, aristocratic or upper middle class person. And it was super high prestigious to be an officer. It was very dangerous. You would die. Famously, you know, it's officers died at higher rates than enlisted men through most of history. And there was a point in the British Empire at the height of it where you could go to like a bank in Hong Kong and like take out a loan based on the fact you held like the King's commission, you know, like that it was good as credit, which is, I think, as high as prestige get. It was literally fungible for money, right? Like, it's a prestige as a substitute for money in society. It was literally fungible for money, and even before that, it was just, it might, 900 had the price was gone, but you should actually be able to sell your commission. Like, it used to be a holding that paper that was signed by the king that said you were an officer. It used to be a thing you could literally buy and sell. It was so well regarded. And like being stripped of it was like the end of the world, right? You know, it was used to be absolutely ruinous. And with, once again, like the draft, it became just because they need more officers, it was open to just anyone with a college degree and has kind of just become like, oh, that's a pretty good management job, you know? Like there's no point also in going to West Point anymore. Right, because it used to be like West Point and VMI and the Citadel. There were very few institutions you could go to become a military officer. Now, you are there. Sure, there is some internal military prestige to go on to West Point, and that's all.
Yeah, I don't think you could break past a certain point in the hierarchy. But I get what you're saying, and you could certainly.
No, you absolutely can. It's just like a boys club. It's like a frat. It's like having been in a frat. There were plenty of officers. Like Mattis was like an RTC guy. Like these people aren't like it doesn't matter, right? Like if you go to a lower level state school, you are as much an officer in the eyes of society and the military, and you get a degree in sociology or religion, you are as much of an officer as the guy who studied physics at the Naval Academy, which is actually a good physics school, by the way. Just side note. But also, at the same time this happened, officers, we talk about competence with police and like degrading of prestige, and officers' prestige went down. Even as like professionalization increased, they actually got more actual training. And because of that, actual like hatred for officers kind of began to spread in the U.S. military. Like, it is a somewhat derisive, it is extremely hostile and derisive relationship in sometimes some often in the U.S. military, where if you look at, you know, the military before that, it was much more like people love, like loving your officers and generals is very foreign. Mattis got some of it, but not from people who actually like worked under him, if that makes sense. Mattis's thing was literally an op by the media and the Pentagon to like make a general popular. But you look at like the actual leading generals in America.
You're talking about Mad Dog, yeah. Rock Rib conservative.
It never landed for me. I found it all very cringe. You know,
the only people I ever, the only person I saw it land with a libtard once. I saw a libtard who was genuinely, well, I don't know how genuinely it was. They were they were saying online they were concerned about the military, or being now led in some way by someone with the moniker Mad Dog. This was somehow right wing and reactionary and indicative of blah, blah, blah.
And he was always just like a kind of a normal, very normie tier neocon. Like we knew, we were one of the few generals whose politics people knew because his war college thesis was out and it was about like how to invade Iran. It's like, oh yeah, I see where you stand. But even he was somewhat confused, I think, by the public love of him. It was kind of inexplicable. Because even he mentioned like
he was the Julius Caesar who commanded the armies against the Gauls, split from the, you know, the Julius Caesar ruling in Rome figure that was Donald Trump for in the imaginations of the people that really just wanted and still want an American Caesar, and these two like functions of Caesar were for a time represented in these two men
for like 6 months, because they eventually like
but it was you know, it was fun while it lasted or something, right? Like, I think that's what was sort of going on at a psychological level.
He was confused by the media campaign himself that he was this great general after like the invasion of Iraq, because first thing he said was like, I don't know why they're calling me a great general. Like, I was against like the worst generals in human history. I was fighting the worst generals to ever probably do it, you know? And also the technology edge. And then his whole shtick was because the Marines were like the faint kind of, and the army was the actual attack to Baghdad, that if the Marines just went fast enough, they could actually beat them there. And they didn't, right? Like, he kind of viewed it it wasn't a failure. The invasion of Iraq was great in terms of operationally, strategically, but he viewed like his piece as a failure because they didn't beat the army to Baghdad, which was obviously a Herculean task. But and it kind of you see some of his like, you know, his he really is kind of like humble and just kind of a weirdo, Mad Dog aside, before World War One, and even during, maybe like it was probably the dividing line, is that before that, guys used to like love their officers, like even their like lower line, not just generals. Like people used to really, really respect their officers, and you see this in media. Kipling talks about it, and like some were known to be more beloved than others, obviously, but the idea. If you
Like, there's an idea in the Sharp's books, which are book. It's a fictional account of a British officer in the Hellenic Wars, who's he comes up from the ranks. He's not a real officer who like bought his commission. And this idea that he is actually like, his men are more skeptical of him because he earned his job than he did it like the proper way and paid a vast sum of money for it.
Yeah, that's healthy. That's healthy aristocratic sentiment. That's totally. Yeah. That's one of the thing is this flatters my neo-reactionary priors.
We have this idea, I think, sorry, in America that like those guys must be stupid, right? Like, we must be smarter than them because we know that doing a job makes you better at it and spending £20,000 sterling doesn't make you get the job. But people aren't actually stupid because they're from the oldie times. They understood, like, they had dealt with, like, these officers and enjoyed, like, they had seen something and they liked it and they didn't want to deviate from it. Because they rationally expected better results with proper officers, right? Like, and that's where it's hard to convey like prestige of, and that was of like 300 years at that point of, you know, this system working very well and creating prestige. That is so much that it seems irrational, but like people aren't irrational in that respect. And I think when you look at a society and what it prestiges, you have to understand that it's always rational. And that's why I don't think you're ever going to see like the idea of just being POC as a thing that's actually prestigious, and everything that like, you know, affirmative action gets forces people into will just lose the requisite prestige. Like you really can't fake it is what I think the white pill for this episode is, that you just can't fake it. You know what I'm saying?
All right, so that gets us to let's close with actors and performers, entertainers, athletes, which are all the same thing.
Athletes are different.
Well, are they?
Yes, they are. That's not me coping. But I want to go to actors. How much? Actors
well, okay. Let me rephrase that. I think maybe this will answer that objection. Athletes, amateur, like true amateurs in the like, because back in the day when you were Olympic gold medalist, you got reward. Your reward was a laurel wreath. There were no Pepsi sponsorships. So athlete going from a really, and that is an Aristotelian, not necessarily so much Roman, and not necessarily so much Christian either, thing of athletic excellence being a virtue in a positive sense. Which would have been rewarded with, oh, I guess you got to eat at the commissary at the you know, the every polis had a like a communal mess hall, and you'd get free meals for life, which is, you know, essentially, you know, free beers at the local pub for Brett Favre for the rest of his life in Mississippi. Same thing, right? It's not like people are very, very happy. There's no one who considers that like any kind of, you know. But anyway, I think the Brett Favre it's not so much Brett Favre getting that kind of treatment. It's not that anything wrong with having anything against Brett Favre. It's just the shift. Like that's the interesting thing is simultaneous with the prestige in American life accruing to those who are most essentially the highest earners, with maybe some kinds of, yes, you know, okay, yeah, yeah. But the, simultaneously with that, it goes to actors, entertainers, and athletes who are suddenly getting paid, you know, just insane amounts of money. By it was one of my earliest awakenings of.
No, I agree. And the Chesterton quote about like societies that value this over other stuff will, which will worship like, what is it, gangsters and pimps and stuff. But athletes they're just more grounded. They have an actual, tangible, undeniable skill, whereas actors can totally be shut down. And I want to compare Kyrie Irving and Kanye West in this respect, right? Because Kyrie also did a thing that was like anti-Semitic or whatever, and still really has half-assed his apologies the entire time.
When he got traded, he removed his apology from Instagram, right?
Yeah, like And Kanye is never coming back because, like, entertainment is like purely just like Jewish thumbs up all the way down. There's no actual hard stop with like the system. Like, I'm sure the best guitarist in the world has like a YouTube channel with like 5,000 views, right? On video.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Or whatever. You know, and I don't know if I know that. I'm not
saying yeah, no, I get what you know. Totally. Absolutely.
Conceptually. Yeah. And the best actor in the world, probably the same.
Oh, they're working for community theater Black Box productions. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's just whatever, right? But actors, you know, as media got bigger and bigger, they got bigger and bigger. And also, in a weird way, like producers and directors have no prestige, but the job kind of faded. Like, when Howard Hughes was doing those stupid fucking flight World War One movies, you're like, oh, I'm going to go see a Howard Hughes movie. That's like, people aren't really thinking, oh, I really want to see a Spielberg movie. I guess maybe some people, but like, people don't really see movies for producers and directors. They see them for actors, right? That's because, you know, that's on screen. And I wonder about how actors have lost much prestige in the last like 5 years with things like with social media and Instagram, because A, you could like push back on them.
You see, it's like you see their inner thoughts that they publish and you're like, holy fuck.
But also, democratization finally hit them. Like, entertainers were immune from democratization of technology for much longer than any other job, right?
Yes. Well, it was just so prohibitively capital intensive to run anything remotely like a movie studio. To say nothing of distribution, which was its own, like, you literally had a distribution. Like, there were companies that all they did was move physical movie reels from Hollywood to movie theaters, like, literally, or wherever, you know, like, that was a whole thing you could do.
But now social media has created this class of people who are influencers or streamers, whatever, and they're just social media projects, and they are comparable to actors, right? Like, someone like the Liver King or one of these weird, like, any of these weird, like, only on Instagram famous people or only on YouTube famous people who are famous for like who knows what, really, they are on par with celebrities, and celebrities interview them and they talk like on equal footing, and like The Rock or is like the biggest movie star in the world, but he's also like just an Instagram account to a certain extent, and he has to like deal with other big Instagram accounts like as if it's like they're equal, which they are. Like, they're not better. Like, I don't think The Rock is better than the guy, some Instagram guy. They're both equally, you know, nothing. But,
well, to be fair, The Rock could probably crush him in a arm wrestling contest. I mean,
there's a lot of jacked guys on Instagram who are jacked-er. That's another thing.
That's true. That's a good point.
By like this system of like probably sucking a Jewish guy's dick or whatever. And multiple times. There's all kind of stuff he did that's horrifying. That they tried to Brendan Fraser him and he said yes. That's why he's the biggest guy in the world. But like, there are guys who are bigger and gianter on Instagram who have better muscled. Like, if you watch like one of these like bodybuilding pros break it down, like, why isn't The Rock like the Mr. Olympia? It's like, well, he actually doesn't have great genetics for bodybuilding. Unfortunately, he's got like his abdominals don't show in a way that like a bodybuilder pros would, just for genetic reasons, something they do in control. But, and that's fine. Like, I don't give a shit about this stuff, but it's funny to see democracy finally hit that, because people can just look at the bigger guy. You know, like, there are guys, you know, who are bigger than The Rock who they're like the default strong guy, or they have better physiques or whatever. And this is true of acting. Like, there are people who are, and I think this is one of the things that TikTok showed us, is that like Hollywood had like a lock on like the idea of an attractive woman for a long time. And actually, like, a lot of actresses, like, weren't that attractive compared to, like, the average TikTok girl was, like, comparably attractive. Because, like, the prettiest girl, the idea was, like, oh, well, the prettiest girl in any town in America, they all go to Hollywood and they compete. But that's not actually true. It's just, like, people are just attractive all over the place randomly. You know, you can't control it. And I think you're seeing a bit of a democratization of media to eyeball. Like, there are other places you can look that aren't just at like these celebrities in a few movies a year or a few TV shows. and you're seeing a bit of, I think, a loss of prestige. And the thing is, when I mentioned how in the, like the military, it's no longer aspirational. It doesn't seem as if it's as big a deal to get into Hollywood, or people don't want a new thing from Hollywood, because all we're seeing is reboots and remakes, and like the same actors who were big in the 90s and early 2000s are still big now. Like they can't produce new stars because of this democratization, because they have to pick somebody who's not the strongest or most handsome or best actor guy. But if I'm super interested in like seeing a jacked guy, my choices aren't Stallone and Schwarzenegger. It's like 1,000 of like literally the most jacked guys on earth on Instagram. Or if I want to see somebody who can sing good, or you know, whatever X skill, Hollywood doesn't get to pick who that guy is, you know? And I think that's why it's going to be lagging, but I think like after, you know, Leonardo DiCaprio and Tom Cruise and Brad Pitt all like turn 60, who's it going to be? It's like maybe Henry Cavill, like the who caught the very tail end of it, but even he's not like, he's been around for a while. Like that first Superman movie was what? Like 2011, like this stuff's, you know, like they can't produce more.
No, they have a real problem. This is, I mean, I don't want to talk too much about cape shit, but they have, there's like Disney, which now owns Marvel, of course, is in really dire straits. They've news as of like a couple weeks ago was they were essentially backing off of their intended release schedule for the Marvel shit, because yeah, it's not just they were talking about like superhero fatigue and stuff like that, but I think more than, I mean, there's obviously true to an extent, but I don't think that it's that people I don't think that it's necessarily that people are tired of superheroes. Like, I mean, people just think there's a contingent that's just going to want to watch an action movie they don't really care what it's about, and the superhero is a very broad thing. And yes, there's an extent to which, you know, people maybe like certain characters, or they're, you know, people, you know, like Iron Man and Wolverine but I think more than even that, it's kind of, as you say, like the Robert Downey Jr. as Iron Man and Hugh Jackman as Wolverine have really entered into kind of symbiotic relationships with the like psychosocial archetype that they inhabit, like Wolverine, you know, the wild beast man with technological imperviousness, and that's a kind of interesting like Freudian union thing, right? Or the man in a metal suit. They play on deep things, and I think there is something to be said for the portrayals or the ways in which these kind of multifaceted media productions have, because you know, when I'm old enough to not necessarily to not have had at all really any, I mean, before, you know, movies were around for a long time before or these characters I should say were around for a long time before there were these big movies made of them. But I think for whole generations now, or you know, the younger kids and not even necessarily, you know, Zoomers and so on, Wolverine is inseparable from these movies. But now they've hit this wall of having cannibalized all that.
They cheated, right? Because they didn't create nobody and make him into Wolverine or you know, Iron Man. The only one that they kind of did was Henry Cavill, actually, who I guess got lucky. But Marvel,
he's the only one. Yeah, he's yes,
actors.
Yes,
and that created yes. like this issue where I don't want to look at like new Iron Man or whatever.
No,
I
want right. to look exactly. At, that's my exactly my Carl yeah.
Johansson. I want to look at like, you know, it's who gives a, you know, it's they cheated to like achieve this thing, and they sold it to Disney. And now Disney's trying to use this to like create new celebrities, and it just doesn't really hit.
just does no one care. Well, then of course they're also hampered by, like, you know, Iron Man now has to be a little black girl, and pretty much everybody has to be a little black girl, and Captain America has to be a black man, and all this kind of, okay, yes, and there's the negrification effect, but yeah, it's I was thinking as you were talking about, like, the prestige, you know, and the whole, like, studio system, because it used to be, you know, very tightly managed and people understood the power. The Jews running Hollywood in the 1920s and 30s and 40s understood just the brain hacking that is moving pictures on a screen. And so they managed the personal lives of their actors, who were really just kind of, you know, very low level employees, and they still are in some ways, but they have a lot more freedom, a lot more independence. They run their mouths more, of course. But even so, like, it used to be a whole thing, even dating back to that period of, like, the farm girl from Iowa who hitchhiked to California to make it big as an actress, right? And of course, this is sort of typically a cautionary tale. There are the occasional, you know, what was it, La La Land, you know, which was itself kind of play on these narratives and the very Jewiness, you know, kind of excised in for the most part. But it was the whole thing of, like, yeah, you could, you know, there were people who, and there were also people who were passionate about their craft, and there was a whole, you know, period where. And I guess it's still probably to some extent true, less so every day, that if you want to be a script writer, that you gotta, you know, put in your hours as a barista or a waiter or whatever in LA while you shop your manuscript around, and, you know, maybe you get lucky and it gets picked up at some point. Many such cases. Obviously this is the whole starving artist thing, but it's interesting that you don't, I mean, the whole, like, starving artist is itself, like, it's an interesting kind of, it points toward the prestige that accrues to artists. However, you, I mean, again, that's a whole big thing on its own. But I don't encounter that much. It doesn't seem to be much of a draw. I mean, I could be wrong, but as you say, it really does seem to be that the mass media entertainment candidate pool is drawn from internet celebrity and various other kind of, like, the, you know, maybe some producer likes you. You are, like, narcissistic sociopath who signs up to go on, like, Survivor or whatever, and you do well on Survivor in front of the cameras to be, or The Bachelor or something, right? And then there's this whole, like, universe of reality TV that then spills over into other mass media product. Yeah, so the whole thing is really warped, and yeah, I've long, pretty much since, you know, since I was a kid, I've always been just very deeply troubled by what I observe in terms of the state of art, like what counts as art, what gets rewarded, who gets compensated as an artist, as an author, as an intellectual. It's always, pretty much as long as I've been, you know, aware of being in this just completely broken and insane society, just how degraded the what is it? I mean, there are always exceptions, of course, and you know, sometimes the product is okay, but obviously less so these days. And the reasons why are interesting, and I think they're tied to all of these historical processes. I don't know if I'm making much sense.
No, I agree. I do want to point out that I think all democratization will bring actors back down, and it kind of already slowly is. I think the prestige of, like, the previous generation, like, that's the thing with prestige is generational, right? Because, like, in World War One, right, officers began to lose prestige because there's more of them, right? There's just more, period. But if someone had told you when World War One, oh, I served in India in the 1890s, you would still have, he would get old prestige that was bigger, right? So I think prestige is, like, it's very lagging. It doesn't like, you can't take it away really from somebody. Like, even Bill Cosby has a certain amount of prestige still, even as horrible as, like, Bill Cosby's name, you know, means a certain amount of thing to a certain kind of white person who's old and not racist, you know? And so I think, you know, prestige will go away. I think it's really is vanishing, and it's kind of returning. I think actors and police, I want to draw the parallel of, like, I think they're returning to the baseline of, like, kind of hated and not really respected, but somewhat necessary to a society. But, like, you know, everyone kind of agrees are, you know, bad, like, not aspirational to be. And I think slowly, as, like, social media democratizes actors and the whole thing gets worse, and as cops do whatever it is they do, we are going to see them return to their baselines of, like, no respect, very shitty, the worst kind of people. But at the same time, like, that doesn't mean it's going to be retroactive, right? People, when they think of actors as, like, shitty social media losers in, like, 20 years, you know, won't think of, like, Brad Pitt as that. They will think of him as, like, a different thing. The golden era or whatever. Because that's how prestige works, you know? And I mean, it makes sense. I mean, he made Fight Club, you know? And that has a certain value that, you know, no amount of, like, retarded shit by current or future actors that are less and less prestigious could take away.
This has been Culture Terror. Thank you for listening. Take care, everybody.